There's an interesting cast. Her co-workers are girls who are also messy. They are different races from different places, but all lost together. They give themselves names like China and Bubbles and Misty, and at the end of a long shift, they hardly remember who belongs to which name. My character has many different names. She wakes up and says, "Tonight, I'm Delilah, Morgan, Becky." She wants to be anyone else. This is late night television. Cable. China does heroin in the bathroom at work. Sometimes she leaves a burnt strip of tinfoil on the counter. The manager calls them all into her office and yells. The girls will never rat China out. Bubbles has baby daddy problems. Sometimes her man drops her off at work and girls smoking in the parking lot watch as Bubbles and her man yell at each other. Terrible things. In another episode, the baby daddy drops Bubbles off and they practically fuck in the front seat. Misty has been on her own since she was 16. She is very skinny and has scabs all over her arms and never seems to wash her hair. After most shifts, the girls go to Jack in the Box and then lie out by the pool of the house where my character is staying. The girls tell my character how lucky she is to live in a house with air conditioning. They have swamp coolers and live in crappy apartments. My character stares up at the sun from the diving board where she loves to stretch out and thinks bitterly, "Yes, I am so fucking lucky." She is too young to realize that compared to them, she is lucky. She ran away, but still has something to run back to when she is ready. My character doesn't come to this realization until the season finale. Every woman has a series of episodes about her 20s, her girlhood, and how she came out of it. Rarely are those episodes so neatly encapsulated as an episode of, say, Friends, or a romantic comedy about boy meeting girl. Girls have been written and represented in popular culture in many different ways. Most of these representations have been largely unsatisfying because they never get girlhood quite right. It is not possible for girlhood to be represented wholly. Girlhood is too vast and too individual an experience. We can only try to represent girlhood in ways that are varied and recognizable. All too often, however, this doesn't happen. We put a lot of responsibility on popular culture, particularly when some pop artifact somehow distinguishes itself as not terrible. In the months and weeks leading up to the release of Bridesmaids, for example, there was a great deal of breathless talk about the new ground the movie was breaking. How, yes, indeed, women are funny. Can you believe it? There was a lot of pressure on that movie. Bridesmaids had to be good if any other women-driven comedies had any hope of being produced. This is the state of affairs for women in entertainment. Everything hangs in the balance all the time. Bridesmaids could not afford to fail, and didn't. The movie received a positive critical reception. The New York Times referred to the movie as unexpectedly funny, and did well at the box office. Critics lauded the cast for their fresh performances. Some people even used the word revolution for the change the movie would bring for women in comedy. A revolution is a sudden, radical, or complete change, a fundamental shift in the way of thinking about or visualizing something. Could one movie really be responsible for a revolution? Bridesmaids is a good movie, one I really enjoyed. Smart humor, good acting, a relatable plot, a somewhat realistic portrayal of women in a cinematic wasteland where representations of women are generally appalling. Bridesmaids isn't perfect, but given the unfair responsibility placed on the movie, the burden was shouldered well. At the same time, the movie did not bring about radical change, particularly when, as Michelle Dean discusses in her review of the movie for The All, Many of the familiar tropes we see in comedies and in the depictions of women are present in Bridesmaids. She notes that the portrayal of Melissa McCarthy's character, Megan, in particular, treads familiar ground. Almost every joke was designed to rest on her presumed hideousness, and her ribald but unmistakably butch sexuality was grounded primarily in her body type and an aversion to makeup. Within this context, considering Bridesmaids revolutionary is a bit much. Why do we put so much responsibility on movies like Bridesmaids? How do we get to a place where a movie, one movie, can be considered revolutionary for women? There's another woman-oriented pop artifact being asked to shoulder a great deal of responsibility these days. Lena Dunham's Girls, a television series on HBO. The show debuted to a lot of hype. Critics almost universally embraced Dunham's vision and the way she chronicles the lives of four 20-something girls, navigating that interstitial time between graduating from college and growing up. I am not the target audience for Girls. I was not particularly enthralled by the first three episodes or the first two seasons. But the show gave me a great deal to think about. That counts for something. The writing is often smart and clever. I laughed a few times during each episode and recognized the ways in which this show is breaking new ground. I admire how Dunham's character, Hannah Horvath, doesn't have the typical body we normally see on television. There is some solidity to her. We see her eat enthusiastically. We see her fuck. We see her endure the petty humiliations so many young women have to endure. We see the life of one kind of real girl, and that is important. It's awesome that a 25-year-old woman gets to write, direct, and star in her own show for a network like HBO. It's just as sad that this is so revolutionary, it deserves mention. A generation is a group of individuals born and living contemporaneously. In the pilot, Hannah Horvath is explaining to her parents why she needs them to keep supporting her financially. She says, "I think I might be the voice of my generation, or at least a generation, somewhere." We have so many expectations, we're so thirsty for authentic representations of girls, that we only hear the first half of that statement. We hear that Girls is supposed to speak for all of us. At times, I find Girls and the overall premise to be forced. Amidst all the cleverness, I want the show to have a stronger emotional tone. I want to feel something genuine, and rarely has the show given me that opportunity. Too many of the characters seem like caricatures, where more nuance would better serve both the characters and their storylines. In the first season, for example, Hannah's not-boyfriend, Adam, is a depressing, disgusting composite of every asshole every woman in her 20s has ever dated. We would get the point if he were even half the asshole. The pedophile fantasy Adam shares at the beginning of the Vagina Panic episode is cringeworthy. The ironic rape joke Hannah makes during her job interview in that same episode is cringeworthy. It all feels very, "Look at me, I am edgy." Maybe that's the point. I cannot be sure. More often than not, the show is trying too hard to do too much. But that's okay. This show should not have to be perfect. Girls reminds me of how terrible my 20s were. Being lost and awkward, having terrible sex with terrible people, being perpetually broke, eating ramen. I am not nostalgic for that time. I had no money and no hope. Like the girls in Girls, I was never really on the verge of destitution, but I lived a generally crappy life. There was nothing romantic about the experience. I understand why many young women find the show so relatable, but watching the show makes me slightly nauseated and exceptionally grateful to be in my 30s. As you might expect, the discourse surrounding girls has been remarkably extensive and vigorous. Nepotism, privilege, race. Dunham has given us a veritable trifecta of reasons to dissect her show. Lena Dunham is, indeed, the daughter of a well-known artist, and the principal cast comprises the daughters of other well-known figures like Brian Williams and David Mamet. People resent nepotism because it reminds us that sometimes success really is whom you know. This nepotism is mildly annoying, but it is not new or remarkable. Many people in Hollywood make entire careers out of hiring their friends for every single project. Adam Sandler has done it for years. Judd Apatow does it with such regularity, you don't need to consult IMDb to know whom he will cast in his projects. Girls also represents a very privileged existence, one where young women's New York lifestyles can be subsidized by their parents, where these young women can think about art and unpaid internships and finding themselves and writing memoirs at 24. Many people are privileged, and again, it's easy to resent that because the level of privilege expressed in the show reminds us that sometimes success really starts with where you come from. Girls is a fine example of someone writing what she knows and the painful limitations of doing so. One of the most significant critiques of Girls is the relative absence of race. The New York where Girls takes place is much like the New York where Sex and the City was set, a mythical city completely void of the rich diversity of the very real New York. The critique is legitimate, and people across many publications have written deeply felt essays about why it is damaging for a show like Girls to completely negate certain experiences and realities. In the second season, Girls tried and failed to bring race into the show in a relevant way. During the premiere, Hannah has a black boyfriend, and it's handled fairly well. The boyfriend, Sandy, is conservative, and there's a clever moment in which Hannah claims she doesn't see race, thereby exposing that she is not nearly as evolved as she might believe. The episode is smart, but not smart enough, because it misses the point. Clever defiance does not a diversity problem address. Every girl, or once was girl, has a show that would be best for her. In Girls, we finally have a television show about girls who are awkward and say terribly inappropriate things, are ill-equipped to set boundaries for themselves, and have no idea who they're going to be in a few years. We have so many expectations for this show because Girls is a significant shift in what we normally see about girls and women. While critics in their lavish attention have said Dunham's show is speaking to an entire generation of girls, there are many of us who recognize that the show is only speaking to a narrow demographic within a generation. Maybe the narrowness of Girls is fine. Maybe it's also fine that Dunham's vision of coming of age is limited to the kinds of girls she knows. Maybe, though, Dunham is a product of the artistic culture that created her, one that is largely myopic and unwilling to think about diversity critically. We all have ideas about the way the world should be, and sometimes we forget how the world is. The absence of race in Girls is an uncomfortable reminder of how many people lead lives segregated by race and class. The stark whiteness of the cast, their upper middle class milieu, and the New York where they live force us to interrogate our own lives and the diversity or lack thereof in our social, artistic, and professional circles. Don't get me wrong, the stark whiteness of girls disturbs and disappoints me. During the first season, I wondered why Hannah and her friends didn't have at least one blipster friend, or why Hannah's boss at the publishing house or one or more of the girls' love interests couldn't be an actor of color. The show is so damn literal. Still, Girls is not the first show to commit this transgression, and it certainly won't be the last. It is unreasonable to expect Dunham to somehow solve the race and representation problem on television while crafting her 20-something witticisms and appalling us with sex scenes so uncomfortable they defy imagination. In recent years, I have enjoyed looking at pictures from literary events across the country, wondering if I will see a person of color. It's a game I play that I generally win. Whether the event takes place in Los Angeles or New York City or Austin or Portland, more often than not, the audiences at these events are completely white. Sometimes there will be one or two black people, perhaps an Asian. At most of these literary events I attend, I am generally the only spot of color. Even at a large writers' conference like Association of Writers and Writing Programs events. It's not that people of color are deliberately excluded, but that they are not included because most communities, literary or otherwise, are largely insular and populated by people who know the people they know. This is the uncomfortable truth of our community. And it is disingenuous to be pointing the finger at girls when the show is a pretty accurate reflection of many artistic communities. There's more, though, to this intense focus on privilege and race and girls. Why is this show being held to the higher standard when there are so many television shows that have long ignored race and class or have flagrantly transgressed in these areas? There are so many terrible shows on television representing women in sexist, stupid, silly ways. Movies are even worse. Movies take one or two anemic ideas about women, caricature them, and shove those caricatures down our throats. The moment we see a pop artifact offering even a sliver of something different, say, a woman who isn't a size zero, or who doesn't treat a man as the center of the universe, we cling to it desperately, because that representation is all we have. There are all kinds of television shows and movies about women, but how many of them make women recognizable? There are few opportunities for people of color to recognize themselves in literature, in theater, on television, and in movies. It's depressingly easy for women of color to feel entirely left out when watching a show like Girls. It is rare that we ever see ourselves as anything but the sassy black friend, or the nanny, or the secretary, or the district attorney, or the magical Negro. Roles relegated to the background, and completely lacking in authenticity, depth, or complexity. One of the few equivalents to Girls we've ever had was Girlfriends, created by Mara Brock Akil. Girlfriends debuted in 2000 and ran for 172 episodes. It followed the lives and close friendships of four black women in Los Angeles, Joan, Tracy Ellis Ross, Maya, Golden Brooks, Lynn, Persia White, and Tony, Jill Marie Jones. I particularly admire how the show rarely made race its focal point. Joan, Maya, Lynn, and Tony simply lived their lives. They were all professionals, a lawyer, a writer, and secretary, a real estate agent, and an artist slash actress slash whimsy of the week, who dealt with job stresses, romantic troubles, romantic successes, and new adventures, and tried to become better women. It took me years to appreciate girlfriends, and I'm not sure why. But once I fell in love with the show, I fell hard. Finally, I was able to recognize something about myself in popular culture. The writing was smart and funny, and the show did a good job of depicting the lives of women of color in their late 20s and 30s. The show wasn't perfect, but the women were human, and they were portrayed humanely. Girlfriends, to be sure, is a show that never received the critical attention or audience it deserved. But it lasted for 8 seasons and still has a very dedicated fan base of women who remain so relieved to see themselves in some small way. Women of color come of age and have the same experiences Dunham depicts in her shows. But we rarely see those stories because they don't fit the popular imagination's rendering of other girlhood, which is generally non-existent in popular culture. At least there have been a few shows for black women to recognize themselves. The aforementioned Girlfriends, Living Single, A Different World, The Cosby Show. What about other women of color? For Hispanic and Latina women, Indian women, Middle Eastern women, Asian women, their absence in popular culture is even more pronounced, their need for relief just as palpable and desperate. The incredible problem girls faces is that all we want is everything from each movie or television show or book that promises to offer a new voice, a relatable voice, an important voice. We want, and rightly so, to believe our lives deserve to be new, relatable, and important. We want to see more complex, nuanced depictions of what it really means to be whoever we are, or were, or hope to be. We just want so much. We just need so much. I'm more interested in a show called Grown Women, about a group of friends who finally have great jobs and pay all their bills in a timely manner, but don't have any savings and still deal with sloppy love lives and hangovers on Monday morning at work. That show doesn't exist, though, because stability holds little allure for the popular imagination, and Hollywood rarely acknowledges women of a certain age. Until that show comes along, or I decide to write it, we have to deal with what we have. I once was Miss America. In 1984, Vanessa Williams became Miss America. She would later have to step down because of a nude photo scandal. But when she was first crowned, it was an amazing moment for black girls everywhere. Williams was the first black woman to wear the Miss America crown in the pageant's 63-year history. I was not the kind of girl who cared much about pageants or being a beauty queen, but watching Williams and her perfect cheekbones and glittering teeth as she accepted the crown gave girls like me ideas. That moment made us believe we too could be beautiful. While Vanessa Williams offered black girls a new image of who the all-American girl could be, the more traditional image of the all-American girl could be found in Sweet Valley, an idyllic town in sunny Southern California where the lawns are perfectly manicured. Everyone is fit and beautiful and successful. As is the case in most perfect places, life in Sweet Valley is episodic. There is a narrative arc to each day or week or month, always a valuable lesson to be learned from life's experiences. The endings in Sweet Valley are mostly happy. The meek inherit. All good things come to those who wait. There is nowhere in the world like Sweet Valley. Elizabeth and Jessica Wakefield are the sweethearts of Sweet Valley. They are blonde and thin and perfect, even with all their human flaws. The Wakefield sisters are twins, twice the perfection. Elizabeth is the good twin, and Jessica is the more rebellious twin. Jessica is a bad, bad girl. Even though in Sweet Valley, a bad girl is never quite that bad. The sisters wear matching lavalier necklaces, and they drive a red Fiat. Elizabeth and Jessica love each other and are best friends, but they are also rivals. Sisters are complicated even when they are perfect. Elizabeth is responsible and universally adored for her sweetness and patience. She wants to be a journalist. She loves Todd Wilkins, a tall, handsome, and popular basketball player. She works on the school paper and is a cheerleader, smart and athletic, the perfect combination. Jessica likes boys and partying. She is charming and enjoys gossip, flirting, and shopping. She loves to borrow Elizabeth's clothes, and Elizabeth puts up with it because you cannot say no to Jessica Wakefield. She's a cheerleader, too, and although she comes off as a bit of an airhead, Jessica has depth and intelligence. She sometimes says unkind things, but that's because she is impulsive and has a bit of a temper. She's all emotion. Jessica is the kind of girl who gives in to her impulses, while Elizabeth controls her urges, at least most of the time. The Wakefield twins aren't real. They are the main characters of the Sweet Valley High series. I started reading the Sweet Valley High books when I was 8 or 9 years old. I was cross-eyed and wore thick bifocals. Other than my younger brother, I was the only black kid in school, so I was going to be noticed even though I wanted very much to go unnoticed. I was shy and awkward and didn't know how to fix myself. My hair was wild, stood on end, earning me the inexplicable nicknames hair, beard, and mustache, even though I had neither a beard nor a mustache. My classmates also called me Don King. I looked nothing like Don King. He's a man, for one. I was told my parents talked funny, which I later realized was a reference to their thick Haitian accent, which I did not hear until they were pointed out to me, and then suddenly those accents were all I heard. I read books while I walked to school. I had the strangest laugh, somewhat halted and tentative, and a bit of a bucktooth situation. I regularly wore overalls by choice and didn't really know any curse words, so that should give you a sense of where I was on the social ladder. Reaching for the bottom rung. When I first started reading Sweet Valley High books, I wanted girls like the Wakefield twins to love me. I wanted the handsome boys who chased girls like those Wakefield twins to love me. I wanted the popular kids to pull me into the shelter of their golden embrace and make me popular, too. Popularity is contagious. Many movies from the 1980s bear this theory out. I had hope, is what I'm saying, though certainly that hope was fragile. There was one particular group of golden, popular kids at my school. They're in every school, an interchangeable infestation of good genes and big smiles and perfect hair and Guess or Gerbeau jeans. I don't remember much about grade school, but I remember the first and last names of the popular kids. If I returned to my childhood neighborhood, I could point out their houses and other geographical points of interest. I watched the popular kids all the time, trying to figure out how to breathe the air in their atmosphere. They were so American, and therefore exotic because they had freedoms I did not. I was a different kind of American. I had conservative Haitian parents who wanted the best for their kids, but were also very wary of American permissiveness. I was American at school and Haitian at home. This required negotiating a fine balance, and I am a clumsy person. There is nothing more desperate and unrequited than the love an unpopular girl nurtures for the cool kids. One day, the kids in the popular clique were teasing me about what I do not remember. I got angrier and angrier as they taunted me, not only because they were teasing me, but also because I was so painfully aware of the gaping distance between where we were and where I wanted us to be. Walking through the mall, arm in arm, or sharing secrets at a slumber party, or gossiping about cute boys. I liked them all. I had secrets. I liked cute boys. That day, though, I needed to come up with a snappy retort to show them they couldn't push me around, to show them I was cool too, to stand my ground. I pointed my fingers at them like Miss Seeley laying a curse on Mister in the color purple, and I shouted, "One day, just you wait and see. I'm going to become Miss America." That was my mother's nickname for me, Miss America. I'm her beloved firstborn, her first child born in these United States. I loved my nickname. Those popular kids laughed and laughed. For the rest of that year and into the next, they teased me mercilessly about being Miss America, asking how my campaign was going, making comments about sashes and crowns, prancing around in front of me doing the Miss America wave. They incorporated props. Those kids made it clear I didn't have a shot in hell at the crown. But I'm stubborn, and Vanessa Williams had won Miss America, so I began to sincerely believe I was going to become Miss America. I reminded my classmates of my belief regularly, which only fueled their petty torments. I have no idea where I was going with that strategy. The Sweet Valley High books were extremely popular when I was young, and most girls immediately identified as an Elizabeth or a Jessica. Most of the people who knew me would assume I was an Elizabeth, minus her popularity. But I wasn't. In my head and in my heart, I was a bad girl. Misunderstood and interesting. I was a Jessica. A girl who was confident and sexy and smart. A girl everyone wanted to be around. I was the future Miss America, ordained by my mother and Vanessa Williams. I always knew there was something unnatural about Sweet Valley. I did not care. I still don't. I was well aware not everyone lives in a perfect suburb, with perfect parents leading perfect lives. I had been to Haiti, seen incomprehensible poverty with my own eyes, so I knew my relatively good fortune was an accident of birth. I knew there is rarely such a thing as a happy ending. I understood that the Sweet Valley High books espouse an unrealistic, narrow ideal of beauty, blonde, white, thin, and that any town where everyone looks and acts the same is not to be trusted. The one time a citizen of Sweet Valley, Stephen Wakefield, the twins' older brother, dated interracially, that relationship lasted for only one book, number 94, because the couple decided in the end that they were too different. I also knew that verdict was suspect. Like many writers, I lived inside of books as a child. Inside books, I could get away from the impossible things I had to deal with. When I read, I was never lonely or tormented or scared. I read everything I could get my hands on, and my parents indulged and encouraged me. They were strict about things like television and grades, but they never censored my reading material or questioned my love of Sweet Valley. We moved around a lot for my father's job. But Sweet Valley never moved, and the people never changed. The kids in Sweet Valley were a constant, and in a small, poignant way, they were my friends. I waited for new Sweet Valley High books the way other kids waited for new comics or movie releases. Each time my mother took me to the mall, I went straight to Walden Books and quickly scanned the shelves in the young adult section, wondering what the twins and their friends and enemies would get into next. When the series began churning out thick super editions, I could have died and gone to Sweet Valley Heaven. As my collection of Sweet Valley High books grew, I maintained the set meticulously, keeping the books in perfect order and pristine condition. Sometimes my brothers would sneak into my room and reorder the books. Minor skirmishes would erupt between us that often ended with me doing something like burying their favorite toys in the backyard. I was quite serious about my Sweet Valley High books. Nostalgia is powerful. It is natural, human, to long for the past, particularly when we can remember our histories as better than they were. Life happens faster than I can comprehend. I am nearly 40, but my love of Sweet Valley remains strong and immediate. When I read the books now, I know I'm reading garbage, but I remember what it was like to spend my afternoons in Sweet Valley, hanging out with the Wakefield twins and Enid Rollins and Lila Fowler and Bruce Patman and Todd Wilkins and Winston Egbert. The nostalgia I feel for these books and these people makes my chest ache. When I learned Francine Pascal was releasing Sweet Valley Confidential, an update to the Sweet Valley High series set 10 years into the future, I basically lost my shit and began obsessing about what was going down in Sweet Valley. I began marking the days until the book's release. At 2:30 in the morning, on the day of its release, Sweet Valley Confidential downloaded to my Kindle. I spent the next 3 hours reading. There wasn't a page I turned, electronically speaking, where I didn't think, girl, laugh aloud, or mutter, mmm. Reading this book was a vocal and emotional experience. I went to work, and when I got home, I read Sweet Valley Confidential again. The book was, as you might imagine, terrible, an insult to the memory of the original Sweet Valley High series. As I read, I kept thinking, they could have called me. I work cheap. They, of course, have no idea who I am. But still, it hurt to know how many fans of Sweet Valley are out there. Fans who could have written this book in the manner it deserved. Sweet Valley Confidential makes you understand why so many people are lamenting the death of publishing. The book is bewildering. On a fundamental level, the writing is extremely bad. The word appalling comes to mind. The narrative structure is so deeply flawed, it physically pained me. The story jumps from the present told in third person past tense to the past told in first person present tense. Sometimes the narrator changes from one twin to the next, and then other times the narrator is another, lesser character. I have spent more time than I care to admit trying to make sense of these authorial choices. Every so often, some sort of Web 2.0 social media reference is dropped into the narrative, as if Pascal is saying, look, I'm still relevant. Twitter, Facebook, oh my. The twins and their friends are all a decade older, but there is little evidence of any emotional maturity. You would expect that the twins, as women in their late 20s, would have sex lives, but most of the sex in the book is strangely antiseptic. Eroticism from another room, as if the audience is still tween and teen girls. When you do see a bit of Elizabeth's or Jessica's sexual personas, it's written so you can only cringe. Many of the petty grievances from high school linger, and most of the characters come off as the very worst people in the world. The whole enterprise has the feel of caricature. The twins have been written in such a way that makes you think Pascal, who created the series but didn't write any of the original books, has no idea who the Wakefield twins are. Elizabeth and Jessica display behavior so uncharacteristic that the simplest explanation is that Elizabeth and Jessica have both been lobotomized. I don't want to give too much away, but throughout the novel, we're supposed to feel sorry for Elizabeth. However, she is portrayed as such a self-indulgent, self-pitying sop of a woman, you start to feel like she deserves her misery. Jessica, on the other hand, we're supposed to hate, but she's professionally successful and in a loving relationship and has a personality. She seems rational and interesting and as vibrant as ever. She makes mistakes, but in a really human, endearing way. When you find yourself rooting for the person you're supposed to hate because of the overall plot of the novel, the narrative has taken a drastically wrong turn. For the record, Team Jessica forever. One thing remains gloriously the same, though, the gratuitous descriptions of Elizabeth and Jessica's beauty. In Sweet Valley High 1, Double Love, the twins are described thusly. With their shoulder-length blonde hair, blue-green eyes, and perfect California tans, Elizabeth and Jessica were exact duplicates of one another, down to the tiny dimples in their left cheeks when they smiled. Each wore a gold lavalier around her neck, matching presents from their parents on their 16th birthday last June. 28 years later, in Sweet Valley Confidential, the twins look much the same, though their description has aged finely, like wine. Like the twins of that poem, Elizabeth and Jessica Wakefield appeared interchangeable, if you considered only their faces. And what faces they were. Gorgeous. Absolutely amazing. The kind you couldn't stop looking at. Their eyes were shades of aqua that danced in the light like shards of precious stones, oval and fringed with thick, light brown lashes, long enough to cast a shadow on their cheeks. Their silky blonde hair, the cascading kind, fell just below their shoulders, and to complete the perfection, their rosy lips looked as if they were penciled on. There wasn't a thing wrong with their figures, either. It was as if billions of possibilities all fell together perfectly. Twice. When I first read the passage from Sweet Valley Confidential, I woke someone up with my laughter. I literally applauded because I was so thrilled by the exquisite badness. To be fair, Sweet Valley Confidential could never have satisfied the expectations of those of us who fell in love with the original Sweet Valley High series. Like I said, nostalgia is powerful, and that power builds with time. It often reshapes our memories. It's not that the original Sweet Valley High books were the mark of great literature, but that to some preteen and teenage girls, the books were the most familiar and resonant expressions of our angst and our fondest wishes for ourselves, the girls we wanted to become. There is a young girl heart still throbbing in many of us. Those of us who read Sweet Valley Confidential were looking to recapture some of the Sweet Valley magic from our youth. Despite the book's flaws, the magic was very much there for me. I easily embraced the drama, the absurdity, the wild implausibilities. You would not believe what's going down in Sweet Valley and who has ended up with whom. But let me tell you, it's all a delicious scandal. Someone's gay. Someone betrayed her sister. Someone's living in New York City. Someone got married to a wealthy but controlling man and lived in Europe until she escaped. Someone is engaged to be married, and everyone's talking. A guy we all thought was a prince of a man is really just a man. Someone has turned into a real bitch. Someone uses baking to sublimate her sorrow. Someone had cancer. Someone became a real asshole. Someone hasn't changed one little bit. Someone got filthy rich. Someone got filthier rich. Someone died. Someone loves someone else in a tragic, unrequited way. Amidst all the drama, some things in Sweet Valley don't change. There are many happy endings. As mindless escapist entertainment, Sweet Valley Confidential delivers. I was never going to become Miss America. I know that now. Vanessa Williams and her glittering teeth could only do so much. Nonetheless, I continued to have a very active fantasy life. In one of my more elaborate, embarrassing flights of fancy, I win an Oscar for writing the best adapted screenplay based on my best-selling novel, which has graced the New York Times bestseller list for at least 57 weeks. At the Oscar ceremony, I am wearing something flawless by a designer with a long, exotic name. My hair and face are beat. I don't trip when I walk up the stairs in my Louboutins to accept my honor. My date is my husband, who is the most handsome, famous movie star in the world. He is madly, uxoriously in love with me, and he beams as I stare into the audience. He will win Best Actor later in the evening because he starred in my movie. That's how we met. In my acceptance speech, I thank my parents and my agents and my famous movie star husband and my friends. I thank Francine Pascal for creating the land of Sweet Valley and Vanessa Williams for teaching me I could be beautiful. Then I call out the names of the golden, popular kids who never loved me. I raise my Oscar over my head with one hand, and I point my fingers at a camera with the other, once again like Miss Seeley laying a curse on Mister. I say, I once told you I was going to become Miss America. This isn't the Miss America crown, but it's pretty damn close. As a black girl, as a Haitian girl, I was not supposed to see myself in the Sweet Valley High books, but I did. Perhaps it was because I too lived in the suburbs. Perhaps it was because I was looking for the way toward a perfect life and becoming Miss America, but I felt the Sweet Valley stories deeply. I read and reread the books countless times. The drama, recycled plots, and ludicrous circumstances spoke to me profoundly. This may also explain why in high school I became utterly devoted to Beverly Hills 90210, which took the Sweet Valley High formula and elevated it to high art. Sweet Valley Confidential reminded me of my most awkward years and the silly promise I made to a silly group of kids. The book reminded me of the solace, escape, and quiet joy I found in Sweet Valley. Some experiences are universal. A girl is a girl, whether she lives in West Omaha or Sweet Valley. Books are often far more than just books. Garish, glorious spectacles. The green girl likes to watch herself suffer. Kate Zambrino, Green Girl. In her groundbreaking book, Gender Trouble, Judith Butler asserts that gender is a performance, an unstable identity that forms through how it is performed over and over. She writes, "Gender ought not to be construed as a stable identity or locus of agency from which various acts follow. Rather, gender is an identity tenuously constituted in time, instituted in an exterior space through a stylized repetition of acts. The effect of gender is produced through the stylization of the body, and hence must be understood as the mundane way in which bodily gestures, movements, and styles of various kinds constitute the illusion of an abiding, gendered self. While our conceptions of gender have evolved since the publication of Gender Trouble, there is a lot to be said for Butler's theory, particularly when it comes to the ways in which women, knowingly or unknowingly, perform femininity, and the ways in which women are sometimes trapped by how they are expected to perform their gender. In popular culture, the world often feels like a stage on which women perform, and no novel in recent memory has captured this performance and how fraught it can be better than Kate Zambrino's Green Girl. The best word to describe Green Girl is searing. The novel is at once a compelling narrative about a young American woman living in London and an indictment of what ails our culture. Rampant consumerism, shallow human connection, and most of all, the cult of beauty and the unbearable and impossible constraints of gender. A culture where women wear their faces as masks, their bodies as shields. Throughout the novel, the Green Girl is as foolishly bold as she is vulnerable. She inhabits her contradictions in deeply seductive ways. If, as Butler believes, gender is a performance, Green Girl is a novel about a young woman who is learning how to perform her femininity, who is learning the power of it, the fragility. Her education is, at times, painful. The Green Girl is as vicious as she is vulnerable, and Zambrino deftly exposes both this viciousness and vulnerability in her protagonist. Green Girl reveals the intimate awareness many women have about the ways they are on display when they move in public, about the ways they perform their roles as women. Quote, "The awareness on the train, the fashion show. The men are always looking with their flirty eyes. One can shop, but does not have to buy. But sometimes life in the spotlight can be difficult. Sometimes she wants to be invisible." End quote. In Green Girl, Ruth is playing the part of girl. Her performance at times stands in place of her identity. As Ruth realizes, quote, "Sometimes she is struck by the sense that she is someone else's character, that she is saying someone else's lines," end quote. The Green Girl also does one thing and feels another because, quote, "The passivity of the Green Girl masquerades as politeness," end quote. She wants to put her fist through a window, but doesn't because she knows that's not what is expected of a Green Girl. She knows she is beautiful, but does not necessarily feel her beauty inside. Throughout the novel, these tensions are brightly exposed over and over. At times, the novel makes it seem that to be a Green Girl is to be in a rather hopeless predicament. Ruth is a shop girl responsible for selling a perfume, Desire. She is always on display at work while also part of the scenery. One morning at work, she observes a group of teenage girls. Quote, "The girls slinking up the aisles have a rehearsed quality to them. Their purses positioned just so on their shoulders. Their eyes downcast yet somehow watchful. They cannot escape this self-awareness. They are playing the role of young girls. Girls younger than Ruth." End quote. There is an irony in Ruth's observations. Throughout the novel, she plays the role of the young woman, and her self-awareness and at times self-loathing is palpable and as inescapable as the self-awareness she sees in those teenage girls. Zambrino demonstrates the self-absorption and vanity of the Green Girl, her insecurities, the masks she wears, her conflicting desires. At times, Ruth wants to shield herself from the gaze of strangers. She closes in on herself, tries to occupy as little space as possible, whether walking down the street or taking the tube. At other times, she wants to be seen, desired, loved. She is, at one point, willing to exploit herself to an unnamed former lover. Quote, she prays to be preyed upon. She is a deer standing in the middle of the forest road, knees buckling, begging for a predator. End quote. Ruth, like so many of us, wants everything, all at once. Though this is a novel about women, there are, indeed, men in Green Girl. The man at work Ruth longs for, the brutal former lover she longs for, the seemingly platonic lover she yearns for until they consummate their relationship, at which point she longs for something else. Ruth has desires, but those desires seem largely removed, lacking in immediacy, and rarely do those desires come into sharp relief. When Ruth has sex, it is often in a detached manner. Her partner's rather incidental to the act. Ruth herself incidental to the act. Ruth has an assignation with a bartender in the supply room of the bar, her detachment finely honed. Quote, she is the voyeur of herself, end quote, Ruth observes. And later, when Ruth and the bartender are fucking, quote, she has seen it all before, as if in a dream, but she is not really there, not really, end quote. In The Laugh of the Medusa, Hélène Cixous states, woman must put herself into the text, as into the world and into history, by her own movement. Green Girl is fascinating for the ways Zambrino puts woman into the text, physically and emotionally. Ruth wants to escape. She wants to escape outside of herself. Everywhere she goes, she wants to confide. Do you know what it's like not to be able to shake your own quality? She doesn't want to be. She doesn't want to live. She wants to lose herself. Lose herself in the crowd. She is somehow numbed to the horrors of every day. Images, other images haunt her brain. The violence of life, she observes blankly. More than anything, Green Girl is relentless in what it reveals about the Green Girl and her inner life. The emptiness and loneliness, the naked violence of it, how she must swallow it, quote, deep, deep inside, end quote. The novel makes it seem like there is a Green Girl inside all of us, as desperately fragile as she is resilient. The Green Girl is able to understand the damage she does to herself, even if she does nothing to prevent it. If Ruth is woman as Green Girl Rising, Maria Wyeth in Joan Didion's equally scorching Play It As It Lays is the Green Girl as she falls. The Green Girl as she tires of playing the part of girl. The Green Girl as she decides to stop playing the part of girl because she no longer has any need, or perhaps desire, to do it. Even though Play It As It Lays was published in 1970, little has changed when it comes to woman as spectacle. Maria Wyeth is tormented and a bit tragic, but there is tenacity about her. The novel chronicles Maria's descent into madness after having an abortion at the bidding of her estranged husband. Her descent is more controlled than you might imagine. Play It As It Lays reveals a complex web of relationships among Maria and her husband, Carter, their friends, Hélène, and BZ, her lover Les Goodwin, and her former lover, Ivan Costello. And it also discloses how these people break themselves against one another in rather terrible ways. There is also a young daughter, Kate, suffering from an unspecified condition and living at a facility away from home. A daughter Maria openly yearns for, and who is the one person in the novel for whom she demonstrates genuine affection. Like Ruth, the Green Girl, Maria, as a never-quite model and actress, is always on display and aware of it, craving the attention as much as she despises it. Living in Hollywood, she is, like Ruth in the store where she works, just another part of the scenery.